Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
It must be History Month here at Research on Religion, because we are continuing with another interview that takes us back to the ye old past with my guest, Professor Gary Richardson. Gary is a professor and economic historian in the Department of Economics at UC Irvine, having received his PhD from UC Berkeley about 15 years ago. He has penned several dozen published articles and reports for the National Bureau of Economic Research, primarily on the history of banking as well as the organization of craft guilds back in the Middle Ages. How religion relates to these guilds will be the topic of our discussion today. I should also note that Gary is currently on sabbatical from UC Irvine while he is at the Federal Reserve Bank in Richmond, Virginia. We will link to some of his NBER reports and other interesting tidbits on our website, and as usual, y'all are invited to visit us and click those links. Gary, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me.
You, as an economist might say, have a very interesting and diversified portfolio of research interests. Now, I noticed reading through your bio, a good portion of your work happens to be done on financial regulation and banking crises in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, although you have extended those studies back backwards in times to the 1700s, as well as bringing it up to the present. But then there's all this stuff on medieval craft guilds with a few papers on religion built in there. And you just look down your list and you can add the smattering of other topics. You've looked at the economics of suicide bombings, product brandings, and immigration. You're all over the map. So let me ask you this. How'd you come to study banking crises and craft guilds?
Oh, this is I have to tell you the story. So when I applied to PhD programs, I said that I wanted to study kind of macroeconomic history, maybe financial history. So that's I wanted to combine sort of history and macroeconomics, or maybe do like history of economic growth. And I went to Berkeley, which was, you know, the best school in those areas. They had Barry Eichengreen and Christy Romer, who were kind of macroeconomic historians, and when I was there, they got Brad DeLong, who also works in those areas. And they also had Paul Romer, who is, you know, kind of famous for reviving the study of growth theory and for writing these, you know, seminal papers on endogenous growth. So I went to Berkeley, and I, you know, kind of was working there thinking I would become a little growth theorist or do some macroeconomic history. And, you know, they had the leading professors in those areas. And I came up with some ideas, and I would say, well, what do you think about this idea or this idea? And they would say, well, that's not that exciting.
I have that same experience, is that when you go to somebody with that expertise and you try to knock on the door of their expertise, they just say, no, that's not that exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I kind of kept in the back of my mind sort of working along there. But then I wrote for my second year paper, you have to write, my second year I did econ, European Econ History course, and I wrote this paper on guilds in England. And, you know, sort of wrote about that, and the professors thought that was really interesting. So it would say, oh, you're like, what about this idea on the Great Depression? They'd say, nah, that's not that good. But what about that thing on guilds you wrote? That was pretty good. You should do more of that. And so I sort of started working on guilds, or the way we organize religion and society in early modern England. And I got interested in that, and it was kind of exciting because I'm terrible with languages. So to do the research, I had to learn a language, but it was one I didn't have to speak because it was Latin. So I needed Latin to read the documents and translate data, but except for some Jesuits, you know, few people, and some classics professors, few people actually speak that language anymore. So I wanted to give it a go at working on a language that I didn't have to worry about the speaking part, which I can't do very well. And then I got to go to England for a year, you know, to do research, and I'd never studied abroad. I wanted to do that, so sort of personally fit in with things I wanted to do, and it was pretty fascinating. And I found lots of information, and I went to England to look at a census of corporate organizations that was gathered by the king in the late 1380s. And that was the primary source that I really was using for my dissertation and a couple of papers I wrote after my dissertation.
Now, I have to stop you and ask this because I'm fascinated by the historian craft, and we had a historian a few weeks ago, and I kept prompting him on these questions. When you went to the archives to look at these old census data manuscripts from the king, were these the old things published on vellum, and were you actually holding them and they were crinkling in your hands or something?
Yeah, they were never published. So these were returns that were sent in for a reply of information about your corporation, or what we would call a corporation today.
Mm-hmm.
Then they had a list. They said, you have to describe your organization. They called it like fraternity, brotherhood, guild, craft, corporation. They had a big long list to try to name any kind of group that people could be in. But they said, if you have a formal group that has some rules or privileges, you have to write a description of that group and send it in to the royal government. Or they said, or your group will, if you don't do that, then all your privileges as a group will be invalidated. So it was sort of a request for information, and it's not clear why the government did this. Maybe they were worried about what all these organizations were, and they just wanted information. Maybe they wanted to figure out how they could tax them.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is in the wake of the plague, and there's big changes in the structure of society. So I had, you know, seen descriptions of this census in some books, 19th century books that are on the shelves in Berkeley's library. And there was two books in particular that had translations of a lot of that and information from a lot of that. One was a book describing kind of confraternities and parish fraternities in late medieval England by a guy, H.F. Westlake, and another was a book on guilds by a person named Toman Smith. He did all the translations or a lot of the basic work, and then he died before he finished, so his daughter Lucy took over and finished the manuscript. So you have like these two pretty good sources to just go kind of summarize. Westlake has a table summarizing what's in like 500 of these corporate returns, and Westlake published 50 or 60 transcripts in full. And so these are pretty fascinating. So I started with what was published, and I could see there was a lot of more information. Then you go to the archives, and you get to look at the originals. And yeah, they're on vellum or parchment and a variety of other, you know, kind of forms of writing material, paper or kind of animal skin. And you call them up in the archives, you request them, and they bring these originals to your table, and some of them are rolled up and tied with strings, and others are piled up, and you can kind of look through them, and they're 500 years or more than 500 years old, so they're, some of them are faded, the handwriting's, you know, hard to read.
I was going to ask about the handwriting.
Yeah, spelling's not standardized. You've got to guess at what lots of things mean, or, you know, there's sort of a science to this. There's lots of books that tell you, like, what are all the variants of how to spell, write this letter, what are all the variants of how to spell this word, and the scribes often, they use a lot of shorthand, so you got to figure out what the shorthand is. You know, they're writing things, these materials, to be read not by graduate students, you know, 700 years later, but by some other scribe who knows their handwriting and the kind of shorthand they use. And so the documents were really easy to interpret long ago, but not pretty difficult to interpret now.
How absolutely inconsiderate. They should have been thinking about those graduate students a couple centuries in the
future.
Yeah,
it would have been more convenient for me.
Did you get shivers up your spine touching this? Because one of the things that I just love about history is when you see some of these artifacts and, you know, they're pulling them out of the archives, and you might have been the first one to actually touch something like this in a couple hundred years. I mean, it's stored in a box or something. Does it just transport you back to that time?
Oh, yeah, no, they are very, it's very exciting to look at. Those documents actually were pretty heavily used by scholars. The scholars I mentioned to you in the 19th century had used them. And then it turns out that English, the students kind of studying medieval theater and literature had been looking a lot at these, the same documents I was looking at. So there was a professor in the English department at Berkeley who, and she and her graduate students had been using those documents to study English kind of literature and plays. So when I did my dissertation proposal, I had a legal historian was on my committee, and I had a English professor.
Mm.
Because the English, the legal historian knows all about the laws, and then the English professor knows all about the documents, because her students were studying those documents to get an idea of what English theater was like in the late 1300s.
Well, you're certainly an eclectic mix of different influences here. The one influence, though, that we're interested here on the show is about religion. Now, I know I've read a lot of economic history. I'm a big buff of economic history, and craft guilds are very important in medieval era. So a lot of people have done this, but why religion? Not that many people have studied the religion angle.
Well, when I started doing this research, it was, I'm a PhD student in econ. I'm in the econ department, so I'm supposed to be writing about the economics of these organizations. That's kind of what I was interested in. Like, what are they doing? And there's all these stories you hear about guilds being monopolies and being counterproductive. That was a very common theme, and particularly coming out of the kind of late 19th century sort of socialist or Marxist traditions of history, to look at the guilds as these groups that were sort of bad for society, and thinking of them as like we think of interest groups today. And I wasn't sure that was the case, and I was kind of trying to figure out what they were doing economically. When you start looking at the documents, you see like 2 or 3% of these documents relate to the economic stuff that these organizations do. And then, 30 or 40% relate to all their social activities, and then half of it is all about religion. When I started my dissertation and some of my early papers with quotes from all these, old econ historians saying, "Oh, it's really hard to do actual research when you look at documents from guilds, craft and merchant guilds in England and in Europe, because you can't really find the material about economics. It's just there's so much stuff about their social activities and their religious activities, and it's like, 97% of documents about religion, people are saying. And, it took me a year or two of studying this stuff to think, well, if all the documents are about social activities and religious activities of these organizations, and a lot of the rules relate to religious activities and a lot of the money they're collecting relates to religious activities, maybe that's worth thinking about. There must be a reason the documents are so heavily focused on these religious aspects, and maybe, religion played a really large role in these organizations.
It is kind of funny, because sometimes people tell you exactly what's on their mind, and it's sitting right there in the documents, and, 700 years later, people are skimming through that saying, that can't be important. So let's dig into why religion is going to be important, but I think a lot of our listeners are not going to know very much about craft guilds. You might have heard it in a college course a little bit, but not that many people know it. So go ahead and take us back to a simpler and happier time, I would imagine. Tell us about those things that you studied called craft guilds. What are they, and when did they emerge in European history?
Okay. So let me first say, you say a simpler and happier time. People often, kind of romanticize about the past. It was in many ways simpler, less technology, but in some ways more complicated, because there's a much greater variety of organizations then. This is early in the evolution of organizations, so there weren't clear types of corporate forms that had evolved and that the legal system recognized. So you kind of, in a way, you're seeing these nascent and inchoate organizations that can have a greater variety and lots of features that we don't think of corporations today, although there's a lot of parallels. And then happier, I don't know if it was happier than today.
Mm.
I mean, I'm not sure about that.
Okay. Well, they didn't have to worry about global warming or Ebola. or banking crises.
Oh, but they had to worry about the Black Death. They had short lives. Yeah. They had their kids died at very high rates. I mean, there's things that we don't worry about today because they're no longer problems that were huge problems in those people's lives. Okay. So I'm not sure that there was any less fear on the part of these people and any more happiness. But anyway, let's go back and talk about what are these organizations. So what guilds, sometimes when you sort of want to introduce this topic, I would steer away from the word guild because people get kind of views of what these are from high school history or from some survey course, and a lot of those views are probably just distorted and wrong. Just think of these as groups of people. So I'm looking at groups of people in medieval England. And I have a couple papers on groups of people in villages. And one of my papers looks at kind of how villages are organized, and it turns out that there's in every village in England, there's probably at least one prayer society where people are organized to pray for their salvation of their souls. Today, we refer to these organizations as chantries or prayer societies. Congregations would be a good term for this. So I looked at the villages and said, look, there's these kind of congregations and prayer societies in every village in England. We have, statistically, it looks like there's probably between one and two per village. And probably one in every village. Now, when you look at the towns, we see there's lots of organizations in towns, lots of groups. And these groups are a couple of dozen people. The biggest there may be 40, 50 adult males. There's a few outliers in England that are in the hundreds of active members. But, you know, probably a couple of dozen to 50 would be a kind of size of these organizations in terms of sort of stable membership, kind of stable dues-paying members.
You mentioned the difference between a village and a town. So a village is a small town, I guess, and a town is a bigger village. What sizes are we talking about here?
Oh, so the villages, and particularly when you think villages, think that's a place who's primarily, its primary industrial or primary occupational activity is farming and agriculture. So the villages, you know, maybe 20 to or 25 to 100, 150 households would be a huge village. Those would be sort of the biggest villages. But a lot of these villages are probably in the 25 to 50 house range. And then back at that time, the villages, you know, are often organized around a parish church. Some of the bigger villages might have a couple of churches, and then the villages sort of the villagers collectively manage their fields. So there's some kind of cooperative organization in the village for farming and for religion. Then the towns, the smaller towns are maybe on order of 100 buildings, 100 households, and then those grow in size. You have some, and you probably have 60 to 100 towns in England that are like 100 buildings, 100 households.
Okay.
And then you have some that are bigger on the 500 to 1,000 household size. And then London is maybe, which is the biggest, is maybe 5 or 6. I'd have to think in, it's been a long time since I looked at the population, but it's probably on order of 5 to 10,000.
Okay.
Households, buildings. So, reasonably big.
Mm-hmm.
So 10,000 households, maybe, 40, 50,000 people. Although London in particular has a fluctuating size because people move in and out of London based on kind of the seasons of the year and whether Parliament's in session or not.
Okay, continue on. Tell us about these towns and these organizations.
So there's these organizations in the town, sort of groups of people doing things. And so I look in the late 14th century at what kind of groups there are. And one thing you see is every group is organized in a way where they're the people get together to do a bunch of different things. And one of those things is, in every case, some kind of collective worship that's dedicated toward, you know, sort of their Christians. So it'd be the, this is pre-Reformation, so there's various versions of Catholicism that are in existence. And at the time, there's a widespread belief in doctrines of purgatory. So a lot of the focus of these organizations is to pray for the salvation of the member souls and help them in the afterlife, you know, help them get to, if they die, you know, to a good place, sort of into heaven. And these societies, they're organized where the members are going to do this for themselves. So there's, at that time in sort of the European Catholicism, there's different views about purgatory and different views about how you get into purgatory and who can help you. And you've probably heard, there's a lot of people have written about the problems this doctrine causes in the Catholic hierarchy and the debates that they have, and then the protests that come out of this, and, you know, that kind of trigger the Reformation in the 15th century, and then the religious wars that go on for a couple hundred years. And they, you know, there are debates about this doctrine and whether it's good or bad, and then about who should help you out of purgatory and how they do this. And a lot of the Reformation is a reaction against the kind of these particular doctrines and the methods that the Catholic Church is using to kind of extract money from people by kind of monetizing your debt to the church and to the Lord, and by saying, you know, the more money you give to the church, the quicker your passage will be through purgatory. And I say yours or your kind of family or in your descendants. And then Martin Luther, you know, he reacts very badly to these Catholic Church's campaigns to raise money by promising people salvation. Now, there's a different strain of belief in the Catholic Church at that time, and this comes out of ideas espoused by the mendicant friars, different orders of monks that spread a doctrine in the 13th century, starting in the 13th century and really heavily in the 14th century. And so here I'm particularly thinking about the Franciscans, but the other orders of monks too, that go out to the population and teach them that the route to heaven lies through yourself, your own actions, and the your relationship with your family and your friends. And the Franciscans and the other mendicant friars spread this doctrine that salvation comes through not the efforts of this kind of rich hierarchy, but the efforts of the people, the individuals. You know, organize a congregation, and in that congregation you promote social kind of mutual insurance, helping each other during your lifetime. You also promote this collective worship of Jesus and of God and sort of the Christian religion. And you collectively help each other get into heaven by kind of monitoring your behavior now on earth, making sure you're, you know, sort of behaving the way you should if you want to get in heaven. And then by praying for the salvation of each other's souls, particularly after you pass away. And so the people find this doctrine, and when I say people who live all over England, but particularly in a lot of English towns, find this doctrine very attractive. You know, the idea that you can form your own group, your own congregation, and promote, you know, your own salvation, your own spiritual growth. And the doctrine's attractive enough that probably everybody in every town in England, or close to everybody in every town in England, is a member of one or more than one prayer societies. And we can, you know, judge that by looking at the total number of people living in towns, which was documented through various censuses and stuff, and then the total number of organizations that we see documented through other censuses, and then we get an idea about what's the average number of members of these organizations. And, you know, you can do a little math and you can see, look, there's the membership in these organizations is larger than the membership of the town. So pretty much everyone is in one, and a lot of people are in a couple of these prayer societies or these congregations. So that's sort of the foundation of this collective activity in towns, really appears to come through the organization of all these religious collectives. And there's other organizations. You know, there's a town government, and the town governments existed long before this. And there were some other probably town business activities organized before these religious doctrines spread. But in the late 13th and then throughout the 14th century, these doctrines of religious self-help and forming religious communities of your kind of friends and family and like-minded people, that people find that doctrine, you know, extremely attractive. And it's not surprising. This is the Franciscans and the other mendicant friars are advocating an evangelical doctrine which they think is similar to the doctrine advocated by in the early Christian church. You know, they think that they're advocating that people do what is described in the Gospels and described in the letters of Paul and the other early leaders of the church who were spreading kind of a similar doctrine throughout Rome. You know, form your congregations, form your churches, and then together you as this group of people can find salvation by worshiping the Lord and praying for each other and understanding how to live good lives. So it's a doctrine. The Franciscans are kind of thinking they're harking back to this evangelical doctrine that's been spread in the Gospels, and they're spreading a similar doctrine in medieval Europe. In a bit of a contrast to the Catholic Church. In the Catholic Church then, you know, it's this big, rich hierarchy, and they say, you know, the way you save yourself is you contribute money to this hierarchy, and then the hierarchy prays for you. If you follow the rules, then the priests are the ones who are authorized to intercede with God and get you into heaven. And so people like the alternative, where you're like the early Christians, you form your own congregations, and you pray for each other, and you interact with each other, and together, kind of collectively, you find salvation. So that you have lots of prayer societies in towns, lots of congregations that are forming, and the people are interacting regularly each week or a couple of times a week for these religious activities. Now, many of these groups organize along the lines of people in similar occupations. And you say, you know, why occupations? Well, at that time, there is a lot, there's still some kind of strong beliefs that different crafts have patron saints. You'll have groups that of people in the same occupation, they'll form a prayer society and then direct their prayers toward the particular patron saint, which, you know, are the patron saint for their occupation. And so it's sort of natural to form these groups of people in the same occupation that are kind of collectively participating in a congregation. It's probably also true that people in the same craft will live near each other in a town. The town usually has what we would call zoning laws today to kind of get all of the, you know, people in particular occupations living together in certain segments of the city, and that minimizes the externalities, you know, like the guys who slaughter animals and tan their hides create a lot of mess, so you want to get all of those people downwind and downwater, and, you know, people who are doing smelting or blacksmithing, they create noise, they create smoke, they create a big mess, so you get all those people living together and working in the same area that minimizes the externalities. So these people, it's like a neighborhood association and an occupation association of all the people praying together. And it's sort of natural that they also help to regulate their businesses. And so I see most of these organizations originate as some kind of congregation. And then because the congregations are naturally organized by neighborhood and by occupation, that once the congregation gets going and is able to enforce rules, like getting people to pray for the salvation of deceased members, and people believe these rules and believe, hey, even after I'm dead, my colleagues are going to, you know, keep praying for me, then they can enforce all sorts of other rules.
Let me Let me stop you here a minute, and because this is something that I had not known, and I'm wondering if it was known within the literature on craft guilds or these groups, as you call them, that these guilds essentially come out of religious prayer societies, not the other way around. I mean, were there economists or economic historians that noticed that there were these prayer or these prayer societies first and then the guilds, or did they just see that as completely irrelevant?
There's few economic historians who saw it the same way I did. I mean, there are books by historians that write about these organizations, and they're like, you know, there are people who think of themselves as social historians or religious historians, women's historians, and they, when they write about these groups, these guilds, they talk a lot about these other aspects. But I think if you look at the leading economic historians, they completely ignored these issues, or they largely ignored these issues. They might mention one or two sentences about it, but I think they thought that either it wasn't important or it was not somehow not relevant,
mm-hmm.
And they wanted to think of why do these groups evolve for economic reasons, and it's like, you know, what are they doing economically, and they kind of ignored all the other aspects of
yeah.
the organization.
And I think we should say narrowly economic reasons, because as you're
yeah.
going to point out there, if you broaden your definition of what economics is, including social organization, it makes perfect sense that these guilds come out of these prayer organizations. But if you're just thinking of economics in terms of money and, you know, fiduciary profit, then you really can put the blinders on.
Yeah, and they're particularly thinking about output. What gets made, what gets produced. And people would ask, when I was a grad student working on this, people would ask me, oh, is this really economic? And I would say, well, it depends what kind of economy you care about, but the church in medieval Europe is one of the biggest and richest organizations that's generating a tremendous amount of what we would classify as, you know, gross national product today. They're providing lots of services, goods and services to people. And people are spending a lot of their income on religion. And, you know, part of when you estimate gross national product, you say, well, what are people consuming? People are spending a lot of their money and consuming a lot of religious paraphernalia and religious goods and services. So, yeah, I think it really is, to understand the whole economy, you really have to understand these broader contexts, because this is, you know, what people were spending their money on. This is what people wanted to buy. A lot of the goods, like goods that are being produced by craftsmen, are being produced to satisfy these demands for religious, you know, goods and services, religious paraphernalia. And so I think, you know, that's all true. The other thing is, I think the way these businesses, and I call the craft guild sort of a business, is operating really depends on it being embedded in a social and religious organization. Because
mm-hmm.
the businesses have lots of rules. They're trying to produce some collective goods, you know, that it's something that's good for the group of people that are working together. And they have rules, and they got to enforce the rules, and they kind of enforce the rules more effectively by embedding the business within a congregation that's providing religious services and lots of social services.
That is one of the key punchlines of your research, although
yeah.
I have to credit you with bringing to the attention to economic historians and the rest of us that these guilds did come from prayer associations. Things
yeah.
are not epiphenomenal. They're very important. But before we talk about the organizational importance of one of these guilds being embedded into a prayer society or chantry, tell us what these guilds did. You just mentioned a moment ago these guilds have rules. They must be doing something for these business organizations.
Yeah, so now, first let me say, there's a huge variety of things, and it varies across time and space. So I'll try to give you some basic ideas and then give you flesh out a little bit the variation. And also, I mentioned what the guilds are doing in England is a little bit different than what they're doing in some other countries, you know, France and southern Germany. So in England, you know, you think there's different kinds of these guilds. There are some groups we talk about and people call are merchant guilds, and I don't do much research on those because there's a huge literature on them already. And the merchant guilds are basically involved in long-distance trade, and they try to solve the problems that you need to solve to enforce contracts over a long distance when you don't have courts, you know, and laws and governments that are going to enforce those agreements. And there's a large literature about the way these merchant guilds function, which had sort of had a similar idea to the idea I had that, you know, the merchants, they value kind of repetition, and so sometimes just the business relationships themselves can be self-enforcing, but often they embed these merchant guilds in communities, like communities of like Jewish communities, and by having your community do this trading, then you can sanction people who break the trading rules by, you know, threatening to kick them out of the community, you know, not marrying your sons, their daughters, or whatever. Mostly I look at what people think of as craft guilds. So craft guilds are groups of craftsmen or who are producing some kind of good. Usually we think of this as when the groups are successful, a product they're going to sell, and if possible, sell on an export market. So that you want a successful guild is going to have a bunch of craftsmen in it who are producing far more than is necessary for local consumption. And so then they need to be able to sell these products to consumers far away. And that's kind of the guild I spend the most time studying. There's also some guilds that are providing local services that aren't tradable, like carriage drivers associations. I think those groups are kind of less interesting. I don't think they're doing that much that has a big effect on long-run economic trends. But I think the guilds that are producing goods that they want to sell in large quantities, particularly on a market outside of their town, they're really important. And so I spend a lot of time, and I have a bunch of articles studying what they do and how they do it. And let me just give you some examples. So London has a very successful guild of pewter makers. And English pewter, or what people think of as English or London pewter, has some really, really nice properties that make it really valuable and a product that people are going to want to buy all over Europe. Now, pewter looks nice when you buy it. And the typical pewter that was produced kind of in the Middle Ages, you know, it looked nice and it's durable. It has advantages over ceramics or wooden bowls and cups and plates. But there's a problem people know about. Over time, pewter tends to, its color changes. And over time, the food that it comes into contact with pewter can taste bad. This is particularly true if you're putting some things into the pewter dishes like tomatoes, like acidic or foods, and just leaving the food in the pewter dishes for a day or 2 days, or cooking in the pewter for just 10, 20 minutes can make the food have a kind of a weird tang to it. Now, today we know what the root cause of is this problem, is that pewter in medieval times and in the past was a combination of tin and lead. And over time, the lead leaches out of the alloy, and that is what makes the alloys finish and color change, and that's what makes the food taste bad. And also today we also know that the lead, you know, it poisons you, it kills you, and it kills your kids, and it's really a dangerous chemical. They didn't know so much about the health dangers of the lead.
But it looked nice.
But it looked nice, and it's durable, and it was pretty cheap. Now, in London, the guild devises a method for making pewter that retains its sheen, retains its shine and its color. So it looks almost as good as silver, and it retains that beautiful look. And the look doesn't change over time. It's very stable, and also the food doesn't get this tang, this weird metallic tang to it. And so the London pewter makers, they figured out a way to make lead-free pewter. And so they take tin, and it's tin that comes from particular sources, mines in England, which, you know, sort of has particular chemical properties, and they alloy it with bismuth and antimony, and maybe a little bit of copper. It's got a little copper in it. So their alloy produces products that's got a much higher quality. Now, you say, how do they, you know, people around the England and outside of England kind of understand when they see these pewter products coming out of England, you know, who made them? Part of it is that, you know, the English makers, they put these seals on their products so that people recognize those seals. It's sort of like a trademark. But, you know, people could counterfeit those seals, so they don't communicate as much information. But there's another feature of the English pewter is that the English pewter is more rigid than pewter that has lead in it, so that you can make the plates and bowls thinner. And also, since it's more rigid, if you, like, tap it with a spoon, it resonates at a different pitch than pewter with lead. So I think when you see leaded pewter and you tap it, you get more of a thunk. And when you have the unleaded, the London pewter, you get more of a ding instead of a thunk. And so people can kind of, they know the marks, but then they really can tell by looking at the thickness and the rigidity and the sound that these objects make. So I call that the conspicuous characteristic. So the London pewter makers, they have a product that's superior, and they can convey that superiority, you know, and their identity to the consumers because it has these characteristics that other producers can't copy. But of course, the London pewter makers, they have to maintain the high quality. So their raw materials are more, like the bismuth, antimony, and copper, more expensive than lead. Now they have a premium product, they sell it for a premium price, but they got to get the members, or each member has a temptation to substitute some of the expensive raw materials for lead. If you can increase your profits, you know, in some substantial way, if you can just cut your costs. So any pewter maker has a temptation always to make a little bit more money by putting in lead, and, you know, as a sort of cheaper raw material. And in the short run, you know, they can put in some lead, they can sell the products. The lead doesn't become a problem until, you know, after people purchase the product, and then over time the lead starts to leach out. So there's this short run temptation to use some cheap, put some lead in the mix, boost your profit short term, but that's a long term cost, you know, trade off, because in the long run your reputation is going to go down, people aren't going to trust you, they're not going to buy your pewter, and they're not going to pay this big price premium for your, you know, London pewter.
Yeah, so not only does it tarnish the actual bowl, but it tarnishes the reputation of this wonderful pewter guild.
Yeah. And so the pewter guild's got, you know, it's a collective action problem. They're producing this common good for the members, which is this reputation, which nets them a big high price. But every individual in the guild has got to resist the temptation to, you know, profit in the short run. So the guild has a bunch of rules that they're going to, enforce to ensure the quality of their product. So they, and you can, you know, read these rules in their in their sort of surviving charters, and the charters say, you know, all of the members of the guild got to produce this, you know, high quality product. They have tests to make sure you know how to produce it before you become a member, and then after you're a member and you have a workshop, the guild is allowed to inspect your home and inspect your shop, so they can go in and they can see, you know, if you have stockpiles of the correct raw materials, and they say, you know, if we find lead in your house, you know, sort of piles of lead, then that's really bad. We're going to sanction you, because I think the only reason you would have lead in your workshop in your home is if you're going to use it to try to cheat.
Yeah, my kid has a lead collection. He wanted to make some pencils.
Yeah, so they say, you know, we're gonna do inspections. Yeah. We're gonna, you know, inspect to see if you have these raw materials which you could use to make cheaper pewter and kind of free ride on our reputations. you know, we'll do inspections, we'll supervise the quality of your products, and then if you're caught, you know, doing something bad, we'll sanction you. And they, you know, sanctions are typically, you know, there's a little bit like a three strikes and you're out law. So they say, you know, the first time we catch you doing something wrong, we you know, there's some penalty, but we give you another chance. But if we catch you repeating this mistake, then we're going to kick you out of the organization, and we're going to try to penalize you to the fullest extent we can. And you say, well, what penalties can the guild impose? In England, it's difficult for the guild to impose a lot of economic penalties. In England, monopolies don't exist, so that the guild doesn't have a right to be the only people producing pewter. The guild can produce this pewter when other people can't, because the guild is only, that's the group of people who know how to do it. But people outside the guild, if they can figure out how to produce the product, they're free to produce it. The guild, there's no patents, there's no law that says only the guild can produce it, and if we kick you out of the guild, you can't produce this, these materials. So the guild, they have to, you know, have ways to sanction people. They don't have kind of strong legal tools to take away your livelihood. They don't have really strong economic means of retaliating against you. Once you know the secrets and know how to produce these materials, you can think of things they might do, like they might try to buy up all the raw materials that you would need and drive you out by creating this artificial monopoly where they own the resources or something, but it's all pretty hard. So how are they enforcing their rules? What kind of big sticks do they have? Well, here is where the guild organization comes into play. The London Pewterers Guild, like most of these guilds, it's a congregation and it's a mutual insurance society, and it provides lots of social services to the members. So the members of the guild, they're in this ongoing social and religious relationship with the other members of the guild. And those services have a lot of value. So that the guild will threaten you. If you're cheating on the economic side of the organization, if you're putting lead into your pewter, well, then we're going to stop praying for you. We're going to kick you out of the organization, and instead of praying for you, we're going to be damning you and swearing against you. And if you're a person who believes in these religious doctrines and religious traditions, that's a threat. And the more you believe in purgatory, the more you believe in the type of Christianity that exists, the more valuable you think these prayers and this congregation is, the more cooperation they can get on the economic side of the organization. And similarly, the guild provides a mutual insurance. Most of these organizations have rules that'll say, well, if you fall in hard times, you know, people in the organization will help you out. If you die when your daughter is young and unmarried, we'll help provide the dowry for her. If something happens to you, we'll take care of your family. Rules like that. And so, or kind of some kind of mutual insurance organized like this. So that the more people value the religious collective, and the more people value the mutual insurance that these organizations provide, the more powerful the threat is that the group would exclude you from the congregation and exclude you from the mutual insurance. And that gives them, with a bigger punishment, the ability to create better collective goods. And so I have a paper with Mike McBride that kind of describes this dynamic. You know, we basically lay out the logic in math like I laid it out in words, and we say you have organizations that could have this be a congregation and could provide mutual insurance. You could have an organization that just provides some occupational public good, like a high-quality products. Those could be separate or they could be together. And we say, in what circumstances do you think these organizations would operate best together? And we say, those are periods in time where people believe a lot about the religious doctrine, so they care a lot about the afterlife. They put a high value on the operation of the congregation, and also, you know, a period of time where families are small, and life is very risky. There's a lot of uncertainty in how long you'll live, how long your wife, your siblings, your kids, your parents will live. So in our model, we really look at these sort of just two parameters. We say, imagine there's a parameter which is the mortality rate. So the mortality rate, you know, moves a lot around a lot in Europe because of the introduction of diseases like the Black Death and other communicable diseases in Europe. And also the fact these guilds are operating in kind of towns and cities which are dirty places and have, you know, high mortality rates, just like cities around the world have higher mortality rates than the countryside today. Because mm-hmm. in cities you have bigger groups of people, and so people are exposed to a lot more communicable diseases. So that we have the two parameters. One is a mortality rate. The other is how much you value the afterlife, how strongly you believe in the doctrines of purgatory. And then we say, look, if you don't value purgatory, if you don't believe in purgatory, you don't care about the afterlife, and the mortality rate's pretty low, which means you're going to have a big family, you're not so worried about kind of being on your own, and that, you live a long time, well, then it's likely that the occupational society and the religious society would form separately. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the people don't care that much about the religious services, they're not going to care that much about being in the congregation, and you can't use the congregation as some sort of stick to get people to behave. But on the other hand, when there is a very high mortality rate and when people believe a lot in the future or in purgatory, and they place a high value on the kind of services a congregation can provide to help you get through purgatory and into heaven, well, then you're much more likely to see these sort of groups evolve that combine religious activities with other activities. Because since the mortality rate is really high, there's a big possibility that, you know, you're going to be dead soon, mm-hmm. and then you're going to want all these prayers to help you get through purgatory. And you believe a lot in purgatory, so you care about it. And since the mortality rate is high, families are small, extended networks of kin and sort of extended relations are small, so you need some kind of fictive kin to you know, help you provide what families would provide for you. So you form these groups of people that provide mutual support for each other and pray for each other. And so you can think, we you know, there's these two parameters, how much people care about purgatory and what the mortality rate is, and then those two parameters should influence the type of organizations that you have and then the amount of these collective economic goods these organizations provide. And the collective economic goods are things like, you know, high-quality products and kind of new innovations, new product innovations. And then we have the model, and then we actually say, now you can map these parameters into data on how groups actually are organized in England. And you see that the model really does a good job of fitting the facts.
One of the other things that came up in your paper with Mike McBride, too, about the Black Death and the timing of the Black Death, is not only do people start to value the afterlife a little bit more because it's becoming a little bit more close to home, so to speak, but merchants have a stronger incentive to cheat or defect from this guild cooperation. It's like, hey, I'm going to be dead in a few years anyway, so might as well get while the getting's good, and I'll put in a little bit more lead into my pewter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, that's completely true. That since you're going to die, there's a higher probability of death. You want to live more for the present. So why not cheat a lot, get a lot of cash, have a big party, have some fun. You know, try to date a lot of women, get a lot of kids, because you're probably not going to be around a couple of years from now.
So it's interesting that there is this mutually reinforcing thing, right? That the afterlife sanctions become more salient. At the same time, there's a tendency to want to cheat even more.
Yeah, no, there's a lot more temptation. And actually, it's interesting when you read the literature on the Black Death in England and the rest of Europe. There's a lot of descriptions of this dynamic. Lots of writers complain at how people's morals are disintegrating and people are behaving in all sorts of what they thought of as unacceptable ways before the Black Death came. You know, people are, they're engaging in a lot of conspicuous consumption. throwing a lot of money into entertainment where they would have saved for the future before. And that's, you know, exactly what we're talking about when, you know, the hand of God comes down, sort of randomly culls the populate 10% out of the population every couple of years. Well, it's, and you don't understand why, what's happening, you don't know how to protect yourself. You think, I might as well have some fun now. Mm. Not everyone feels that way, but certainly some people do. I'll just give you a little vignette from my life on this. It's a way, it's kind of a sad story, but in some ways uplifting. So when I was in graduate school, I had a very good friend who got very bad medical news. He found out that he had metastatic melanoma. So his life expectancy is, you know, dramatically shortened. He's a guy in his young 20s. He's got skin cancer. It has spread. And so the five-year survival rate, when you get that news, is like 10%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like there's not the number. Now, and when he first got the news, you know, he does the treatments and everything, and he's in remission, and, you know, you have some hope. And then he got more bad news. And I told Carl, like, my friend, I said, you know, let's look at this. And actually, we were in his home. He was getting the mail. And he got a couple of these offers for credit cards. You know, and they say, hey, just start using it today. Call in. And, it, you know, you're pre-approved for credit. And so he had a look as, like, this mail had piled up. I said, you have $25,000 in credit approvals here. And I said, you're telling me how you really wish you could have gone traveled to Asia. You really wish you could do another tour of Europe and see these places. I said, look, you're pre-approved. I'm an economist. So I said, go for it. Whatever. These firms, they've considered you. They've decided to give you all this money. And I said, just take it. Just bar it up because, you know, chances are you never have to pay this back.
Mm-hmm.
And as an economist, to me, that seemed totally reasonable thing, right?
Right.
You know, I'm an econ PhD student. I'm like, whatever, the companies want to give you the money, take it.
They
know there's a risk that, you know, one in a million of the people they decide to give $20,000 to can't pay it back.
Yeah, you're using that asymmetric information to your advantage there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I, you know, in explaining how this is totally reasonable, it's like, and my friend was like, no. He's like a really moral guy, and so he said he's working extra hours so he can pay off his student loan.
Wow.
Like, and he did. So he paid off all his debts before he died. And I was just like, I don't know. But, you know, it's different training. There's a lot of studies that show that people who are trained as economists, either because of the selection effect or the training we get, we're just more selfish than other people, or we believe in this sort of hyper rationality. You know, it's like our profession, it's supposed to be positive, but it sort of becomes our norm.
Yeah.
So anyway, but you know, what this thing that happened in my life was just reflects that dynamic of that we see going on when you have the Black Death come into society, and there's a lot of people that, you know, think like I thought and say, well, you know, we might be dead in the future. Things don't look so great. So let's have a lot of fun now.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
But there's that afterlife penalty, right? And that what your friend could be thinking of. You know, that the rewards just don't come in the here and now on a trip to Asia, but it in the ever after, I guess.
Yeah. And you know, he thinks he wants to. It's a reputation he has, and he doesn't want to tarnish that reputation. And he believes a lot in behaving in a moral way. So, you know, he's really internalized a lot of these ideals. And that's, you know, something the organizations that we're talking about really, you know, they're trying to do. They have lots of formal rules that people are going to inspect you, they're going to punish you if you get caught cheating. But, you know, they're always hoping that they don't have to do this. They don't need to punish people. They don't need to inspect because they're going to try to get everyone really emotionally attached to the organization.
Mm-hmm.
So every week, all the members, in a lot of these organizations, all these guilds, there's a rule, like once a week, all the members are going to eat together. They're going to break bread together. They're going to have a meal together. They're going to pray for the salvation of everyone's souls. There is a lot of ceremony that's involved with being a member of this organization and a lot of identity. So most of the towns in England have days where they celebrate their craft, their occupation. So that they have parades, the members of the different organizations sort of march in their liveries or their uniforms, and people like that. They're sort of proud to march carrying the banners or wearing the badges of their occupations. And then many of these organizations, you know, begin to provide some sort of social services to the communities, and they compete to be the organizations that are providing the sort of the nicest plays or the nicest pageants to the public. And I mentioned when we started this conversation that the graduate students of an English professor at Berkeley were studying the same records I was studying. And what they were studying were the plays and pageants put on by these craft societies. It turns out in many towns in England, there were cycles of religious plays and religious dramas put on by the occupations, by the craft guilds. And so different crafts would have maybe one day of the year where they celebrate their patron saint, and they put on a pageant that kind of describes who their patron saint is and, you know, the great things their patron saint and their craft has done for the town. And then around Christmas and around Easter and other kind of big points in the Christian calendar, there would be in many towns, they would hold big fairs where the different occupational groups would put on parts of these kind of traditional cycles of religious plays describing the birth of Jesus, the life of Jesus, and then the death and the resurrection of Jesus, and the spread of the good news by his evangelizing apostles in the aftermath of his resurrection.
I can imagine, too, as the hyper-rational portion of my economic brain here would suggest, that there's a monitoring aspect of this, too. If you have weekly prayer services, if you have monthly pageants or biannual pageants, if you see one of the members of the guild not contributing, you would immediately start to suspect that they're putting a little bit too much lead in their pewter.
Oh, yeah. So, and like you observed before, there's a lot of aspects of these organizations that are mutually reinforcing. So, you know, you get people to hang out a lot together, and you hope there's an emotional bond. But while you're trying to build these emotional bonds and get people so they really value the reputation that they get from being part of this organization, you spend a lot of time together, you know, and you get to observe each other, and that helps you to do the sort of monitoring and enforcing of the rules very directly. And, you know, humans we're complex people. Everyone has a mix of emotions and a mix of thoughts, and, you know, have a lot of kind of tensions, internal emotional tensions when we're making our decisions. And the organizations, you know, kind of know people are people. And so we've got to have multi-layered approaches to people, kind of mutually reinforcing aspects of the organization.
I want to end up here and talking about what happens with these guilds and the embeddedness with religion after the Reformation, because one of the things that you mentioned, the doctrine of purgatory, plays a fairly significant role here. And by the early 1500s, you have Luther's revolution, you have Calvin coming by, and then you also have the English Reformation as well. And this is going to change the doctrinal ballgame, so to speak. What happens after that?
Yeah, so here the Reformation takes different courses in different places in Europe. In England, it takes a really unique course. In England, the royal family initially defends the Catholic Church and these doctrines of purgatory and behavior. There's a bunch of reformist influence in England. There's a bunch of people who kind of would like to change, but the king is known, particularly when you get to the Tudors and Henry VIII, he's lionized as the defender of the faith. Then he gets into, you know, marital issues. He wants a divorce, his first wife, and the Catholic Church doesn't want to grant a divorce, so he changes his attitude. He allows the Reformation to come in England, and then they separate the Church of England from the Church in Rome. When they do that, they dramatically revise church doctrines in England. And part of this revision is to get rid of a lot of the doctrine of purgatory and these aspects of the church that had been so important for the guilt. As part of the English assault on the old religious structure, they actually, you know, they suppress the monasteries. They suppress a lot, all the chantries, and the rural government seizes a lot of the funds that religious organizations have collected to pray for the salvation of people's souls. These seizures also spread to the guilds. So the rural government is demanding from the organizations that they get rid of their religious, all the sort of religious paraphernalia, largely, I think, turning that over to the government or its local representatives. And then the government passes laws that say guilds can no longer be engaged in religious activities. You know, there is an English church headed by the English king, which is dispensing religion and salvation to its subjects. And so craft guilds and other business organizations should no longer be involved in this. And, you know, part of this move is a move to, in the Reformation, to seize control of the church and its authoritative apparatus. Part of it is a move to get a lot of money and revenue for the English crown, and a lot of that then is going to be redistributed back to its supporters. And part of it is also a move by people who, I think, deep down emotionally and philosophically are opposed to the religious doctrines that dominate the Catholic Church and its hierarchy at that time. There's a lot of people who really dislike the way that the Catholic Church, headed by the papacy in Rome, behaves. They think it's abhorrent, disgusting, just terrible, the way these kind of religious leaders set themselves up as a kind of an authority and use their religious authority to extract lots of money from the population, and then turn around and use that money to live a life which is not the kind of life and morals that they're advocating for the population. And, you know, Martin Luther and Calvin and others talk a lot about this, the hypocrisy of the Catholic clergy and the hierarchy in Rome. And so, you know, part of what the English are doing is trying to suppress all of these doctrines which they find so distasteful and which they think have allowed the population to be controlled and manipulated by the Catholic hierarchy. So, yeah, so in England, the Reformation basically separates religion and occupation. It's just the government comes in and says, you can no longer have this link, got to get rid of it. We seize all of the funds you've collected to, you know, support prayers for the souls of the deceased. You got to get rid of or turn over all of your religious paraphernalia. And now if you want to be a craft guild, that's good, but your craft guild is an occupational organization. It doesn't have a role in religion, and it can't. You know, probably some of that was religious activities went underground. People still want to pray together, but they're not supposed to, and it's very difficult for them and to keep doing that.
Yeah, I was going to say, and so ends that tale of craft guilds and religious organization
in England, but not everywhere.
Ah, no. Where else does it stick around?
Well, there's countries that remain Catholic, like Spain and France, and in those places, the medieval guilds, you know, survive, and they continue to behave in the way they've been behaving, so that you see a real legacy of these guilds in France and Spain and some of the other, you know, Italy, countries that remain Catholic for centuries. So in England, you see that with the Reformation in the 16th century, this sort of quick separation of occupation and religion. There are other countries where that link survives for a couple of hundred years. And so, you know, you can look at sort of the long run what happens in these countries. And it turns out that the countries that separated religion and church, or religion and occupation, tended to, in the long run, become more wealthier and more prosperous. And it's really an open question as to exactly what's going on, because it's the guild organization can be part of this, but there's a lot of other features of Protestant religions which, you know, promote prosperity. And people have, you know, talked about the Protestant work ethic. I mean, I think a lot of the research now focuses on education and the Protestant drive to produce literacy, universal literacy, so that everyone can read the Bible themselves. So there's exactly why the prosperous nations, or the Protestant nations prosper, I think, is a really fascinating subject of research. And part of the story would be that the, you know, in the Protestant nations, you have a more rapid evolution of occupational institutions toward modern forms. And the legal system develops to support this more, and they kind of, the corporate structure evolves more readily. In Italy and France, you have, you know, a lot of these medieval organizations survive, and then the church and the religion kind of, this is some nasty, maybe conspire together to keep extracting funds from the population. So the guilds become, you know, less involved in, you know, promoting kind of collective goods like innovation and high quality, and more involved in kind of rent seeking and extracting revenues for themselves and for the government and the church.
Well, that is a story that we're going to have to follow up on future podcasts, because we're about out of time here. But the one question I always like to leave off with my authors is, what have you taken away from this study? I mean, this could be one of these economic studies that's curious for historical reasons itself, but has it changed your mind on a lot of different things, having studied this over the past 15, 16, 17, 18 years?
Well, yeah, I'd say in a couple of ways. One is it you know, this story kind of tells me that religion is a lot more about people and what people want and what makes people happy than about what the kind of church hierarchies are doing. And when I was raised, you know, I was like kind of Catholic, and I went to a lot of CCD and, you know, Sunday school. And most of that, those studies focuses on the kind of the leadership of the church and these kind of famous old apostles. But you never really hear about what the typical person does in a typical day and how important that has been over the last couple thousand years. So I think now about religion much more in terms of what does it bring individuals and how do the individuals behave. So I look at research on the church and congregations today, and I kind of think of understand it from that perspective. I think much more seriously about studying religion as kind of a study of the economy. The Middle Ages is a point in time where religion sort of peaks as an occupation and as a part of the gross national product. I mean, in some parts of Europe, you probably got 10% of the population working directly or indirectly for the religious hierarchy. But then if you look at the U.S. today and you say, well, what do people spend money on? You know, a lot of people spend a lot of money on religion. And yeah, religious holidays have a big influence on the economy. I mean, pretty much everyone's heard of Christmas, and mm-hmm. most people celebrate Christmas, and that's a religious holiday.
That is true, and we have Christmas coming up, and just to announce to everybody, we'll have a couple special shows about Thanksgiving and Christmas in the works, so please make sure to stay tuned. But today, my guest has been Gary Richardson. Gary, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.